It's time to get loose. That's what I'm talking about. And give up the funky juice. It's time to get loose. Get the funky up.
Funky guitar now. It's all I've got for you now. Funky guitar. Somebody take it away from me. You gotta go and buy yourself a funky guitar now.
That's Toots and the Maytals from their fabulous tribute album. Man, what a show they gave at the Orpheum Theater in Vancouver last year. You just had to be there, the best of reggae. It's Radio EcoShock, our Friday excursion into the environment and all the perils therein. Hopefully we'll have some good times along the way as well, although we've got some big, big stories to tell you about. You know, last week we talked about the Stern Report, how a British economist, formerly with the World Bank, had concluded a study saying that climate change was going to wreck the world economy. We just experienced one of our big rainstorms. There are going to be lots of big rainstorms. The rain falls harder and faster than ever before with climate change. We've experienced that here in Vancouver and the flooding of the Chilliwack River, more flooding on the Squamish. Get ready for climate change, folks. But this week we're going to move on to a couple of different topics. We have a report coming out from Canadian-led scientists from Dalhousie University that if we keep fishing at our current rates, all the stocks of edible seafood will be gone from the world's oceans by 2048. Incredible news, but true. And we'll see whether we can turn that around or whether we'll just have to give up on seafood. And how about the billion people around the world who use seafood as their main source of protein? Oh, well. Who cares about fish sticks anyway? We do, and we're going to explore that with a special EcoShock feature called Fish 2048. That's coming right up. Now, following that, on Wednesday's headlines in the Vancouver Sun, the headline is Chemicals Impair Kids' Brains in Pandemic Proportions. We all know there's a lot of new learning disabilities in kids, whether it's autism, and of course we have asthma that's promoted by more smog. But what we didn't know is that these chemicals, and there are over 201 of them in full production in Canada and the United States and around the world, are invading our environment. And they affect the formation of children's brains starting right from the womb. So we'll be playing a special EcoShock production called The Polluted Womb, which looks into scientist Frederica Pereira in New York at Columbia University, her study on pregnant women and the impacts of this mix of chemicals and smog on the development of children and babies. And that's going to lead to a whole generation of people that are challenged, let's say, that have health impacts, that have IQ impacts, and we should be doing something about this yesterday, if not today. Sometimes environmentalists are accused of preaching. Well, we're going to do it double time. We've got a special comedy feature if you want, but it's a little bit more than that. From Kristen Wilson, it was recorded at a Bioneers conference by New Dimensions Radio. It's called Oh My Soul. It's preaching, but from a green perspective and a woman's perspective about what's happening to the environment. There's some humor there. I think we'll have a good time with that. A little bit of music mixed in. We're going to hear from Mr. Stan Rogers about the fishing that disappeared on the east coast of Canada. Perhaps a few other tunes. Let's see what happens. It's Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
I wish I was a fisherman tumbling on the seas, far away from dry land. Out my sweet life with a band of London love. Love's feeling bearing down on me. Save the starry sky above with light in my head. You in my arms.
The world is running out of seafood and running out soon. Exactly 42 years from now, in the year 2048, there will be nothing left to fish in oceans. That's the precise and dire conclusion of a major new study released today by the journal Science. Fish in the sea. Can we undo the damage before they're all gone?
Clam bakes, crab cakes, and even fish sticks could one day be a thing of the past.
Oh my God! The fish are dying!
A new report says if current trends of overfishing and pollution continue, all seafood could be wiped out in 40 years, and not just ocean life. Ecologists are also worried about fish in lakes and rivers. Experts say it's not too late to turn things around. They're calling for new marine reserves, better management to prevent overfishing, and tighter controls on pollution.
That's what kills me about mass media news. Horrors never before known can be reported in those news voices, followed immediately by the trivial, as though the disappearance of fish in the sea is just another story. Personally, I thought this woman's reaction was a little more realistic.
Oh my God! I can't believe it! I had no idea!
A homophobic preacher admits hiring a gay prostitute? Now that is interesting. Everyone is clicking to find out more. The end of seafood? Not so much. These days, notice I did not say in these end times, environmental news requires a horror soundtrack with cues for when we should cry out or scream. I suppose that's part of the mission of Radio EcoShock.
As if predictions about the demise of the coral reef weren't bad enough, scientists also predict most of the world's fisheries are set to collapse in just over 40 years. A combination of overfishing and pollution are being blamed for the problem. Scientists from Canada's Dalhousie University led the international study, basing their findings on almost 8,000 species fished over the past 50 years.
Moan now.
Oh no.
This is Alex Smith, and we're taking a quick tour through the latest horror flick known as reality. The essential facts are these. In the May 2003 issue of the journal Nature, two scientists from Canada's Maritime Provinces released their study, Rapid Worldwide Depletion of Predatory Fish Communities. Their research showed that 90% of all large fish, the upper tier predators, were already gone. Fish like tuna, marlin, swordfish, sharks, cod, and halibut. And they found it only takes 10 to 15 years for industrialized fishing to grind down any new stock to 10% of the original population. The few big fish that are left are noticeably smaller, one-fifth to one-half the size caught by a previous generation. The authors also called for a global effort to reduce the impacts of fishing, including fewer fishing boats, reduced bycatch, an end to government subsidies where they pay for all these boats, and for the most threatened species, cutting the catch in half. Little was done. Norman Meyer said, "We are in a massive denial and continue to bicker over the last shrinking numbers of survivors, employing satellites and sensors to catch the last few fish left. We have to understand how close to extinction some of these populations really are, and we must act now before they reach the point of no return. I want there to be hammerhead sharks and bluefin tuna around when my 5-year-old son grows up. If present fishing levels persist, these great fish will go the way of the dinosaurs." End quote.
We are the dinosaur. We don't live here anymore. We got what we were asking for. Follow the dinosaur. The whole world's dialing 911. The don't walk sign just changed to you better run. What we've been waiting for has long since come.
All right, in late October 2006, Dr. Worm was again the lead author in a major study by 14 scientists from Canada, the United Kingdom, the United States, Panama, and Australia. Institutions like Stanford University, the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, and Stockholm University were participating. It is titled Impact of Biodiversity Loss on Ocean Ecosystem Services, and published in the journal Science for November 3rd. The team analyzed mountains of data about fish catches from around the world, going back 50 years, and even cross-checked against historical records up to 1,000 years old. Dr. Worm couldn't believe the computer analysis, and so cross-checked the results by hand.
And I saw that the trend of collapse of seafood species projected into the future predicts that by the year 2050 there will be no more species left to fish. And I really recall the hair standing up in the back of my neck and a shiver down my spine as I watched over the students, and I thought, it's going to be in all of your lifetime, and in my lifetime too. I'm going to be old, but still I will see this happen if nothing changes, if we don't change the way we're treating ocean ecosystems.
In a moment of disbelief, the figure showed that about 29% of the world's edible fish were already in a collapsed state by 2003. That's over 2,200 edible species no longer commercially viable. If humans continue to harvest ocean resources at the current rate while polluting the sea and the atmosphere, the graph of fish population drops to nothing around the year 2048. The report was cross-checked by an array of the world's top fisheries scientists, but it is common knowledge that we're fishing out the sea. Report after report has showed it. More and more areas are close to fishing, including the record-setting end of the great 500-year-long cod fishery off Canada's east coast. According to the study, species below 10% of their original size include many types of salmon, king crab, some scallops and oysters, tuna, trout, shrimp, sharks, and more. All of this comes as diet-challenged first-worlders are being advised to eat lots more fish to get those omega-3 fatty acids so important as brain food. The study also showed the importance of biodiversity. Ocean life is very interlinked, with special services rendered by both small and large organisms. When part of that natural mechanism is removed, the whole breaks down, and the speed of decline is increasing year by year.
That is true. We see that in the ocean, species are very strongly connected, probably more so than on land. For example, if you remove a large predator species like a shark or maybe codfish, you see a domino effect of cascading ecosystem effects down the food chain. This is something we not see as commonly on land. So we have to rethink for the ocean. We have to envision this as a house of cards where every element of this building is integral to the structure of the whole. What has accelerated is that it's many more people who depend on wild resources like fish and seafood, but also the industrial scale at which we're scooping up species from the ocean, the global scale at which we're operating now. There's no ocean region that is exempt from our impacts. Only 1% of the ocean or less is protected effectively from fishing.
Not all scientists agree with the paper's results, and some fishing nations have gone on the offensive against such dire conclusions. For one thing, even the authors admit they hope to stimulate public concern to head off the problem before seafood disappears forever. Worm and his team of scientists want fisheries to be managed for sustainable yields, with real control over sources of ocean pollution, better maintenance of habitat, and big ocean reserves. Like the recent Stern report on climate, these scientists say such moves are an investment in a livable future, with real economic payoffs if we act, and greater, almost unimaginable, penalties if we go on with business as usual. More than 1 billion people depend on seafood as their main source of protein, not to speak of the ocean's great value in itself. After all these species have a right to exist without us coming around to collect them in nets or throwing them overboard as bycatch. Worm says, it's not too late. We can turn this around.
It's really important to notice that our analysis had a strong upside, and that is, wherever people have tried to reverse the loss of biodiversity through protective measures, they've usually been successful, and they've been successful within a relatively short time period, usually 3 to 5 to 10 years.
But less than 1% of the global ocean is effectively protected right now. He gives better management marks for stocks off the North Pacific, on Alaska, as an example of how fishing can be done sustainably. Sadly, though, most of the rest of the world is becoming depleted and fast.
For example, here in Atlantic Canada, fishing has been going on for 500 years or more, and groundfish stocks, after that long history, finally collapsed in the early 90s. There has been no directed fishery at these species so far, and so this is 12 years, and there has been very little or no recovery over time. The problem there is that we really don't know how to fix it. We're not good at repairing something that doesn't recover on its own. We don't have a technological fix. We can't just replant things like we do on land. We don't know how to do that in the ocean. So we really rely heavily on the ability of the system to self-repair, to recover on its own. And what we show in this analysis is that that ability of the system to self-recover, self-repair is tied very strongly into its biodiversity, the number of species in the system. I think we still take the recovery potential of the ocean for granted. We think if you collapse it, it's going to come back. That's what they thought in Newfoundland. That was what they thought over here. And that should be a strong warning to European countries that It actually can happen that it collapses beyond a point of return where it doesn't recover on itself. And as I said, we don't know how to engineer a solution in that case.
Neelesh Gundar, a spokesman for Greenpeace Australia, says ocean pirates are stealing up to $9 billion U.S. worth of fish a year from some of the world's poorest people. Greenpeace is calling for 40% of the oceans to become protected reserves to save the world's seafood.
So is it, in fact, a war on fish you're describing?
It certainly is a war on fish, and what I'm saying is that we're winning it. We have won the war on fish.
And we're going to wipe them out, the very last one.
That is... It's crazy, but it is exactly what's happened. We have deployed industrial military technology against the fish, and we have obviously won. The biggest fish have brains the size of peas, and the way they defend themselves against their enemies by hiding or swimming fast, etc., to us, they don't make much of a difference anymore. Before they did, if a fish could hide between rocks at 1,000-meter depth, then you couldn't catch it. You couldn't see it, obviously. It was too deep. And even if you could reach that deep with your net, you couldn't catch it because it was between rocks. But now we can see it because we have all the equipment to see it. So we see it ridiculously, like a soldier who has night goggle who can see somebody who doesn't, right? And so we win. We win the war against fish.
Professor Daniel Pauly is head of fisheries at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada.
Just recently, the United Nations is trying to implement a ban on one of the most destructive fishing practices, trawling of the deep seabed, often compared to clear-cutting on land. To its international shame, Canada is one of the few countries opposing the ban, even when Canadian scientists are warning of an end to global fisheries. The same kind of protect-the-jobs thinking by Canadian politicians led to the total collapse of one of the richest fisheries in the world, the East Coast cod. Even with new ocean protection measures, events on land are also damaging ocean life. Deforestation cuts into marine weather cycles as well, and of course, global warming impacts fish and all ocean life. Some marine testing stations in Canada have measured an increase of more than 4 degrees in the ocean temperature. And carbon dioxide from coal plants and vehicles is making the ocean more acidic, hampering the development of tiny sea creatures and coral that support ocean life. Doctors Worm and Myers have also written papers on managing fisheries during climate change. That's something you're going to hear more about as warmer waters power up the hurricanes and fresher waters dilute climate-regulating ocean mechanisms like the Gulf Stream. Extinctions of whole ocean ecosystems are possible if they cannot adapt to rapid temperature change.
We see the end of the line. We see where this trend, which is a very strong trend, is heading. If we go on like we did over the last 50 years, there will be no viable fisheries left within our lifetimes.
Even scientists have leaks to the media these days. An email to colleagues went to the Seattle Times by mistake. In it, Dr. Worm hoped that his projection of ocean death would serve as, quote, a news hook to get people's attention. One reason why nobody cares about marine biodiversity, he continued, is that there seems to be no clear end in sight. Well, it's time to wake up. If the current trend continues, we will see drastic consequences in our own lifetime. End quote. This report certainly got my attention, despite lame efforts to cover it by mass media news outlets. I hope it got yours, too. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, the net's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org. Voice clips are from the Today Show on BBC Four and from ABC National in Australia. We had music snippets opening with the Waterboys tune Fisherman's Blues, a snatch from Bob Holman's We Are the Dinosaur, and ending with the Marvelettes classic Too Many Fish in the Sea, a common expression until now.
We've turned the Serengetis in the world's oceans into deserts, and we didn't even know it.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio here in Vancouver. Well, we hope the fisheries will rise again with some sort of protection for them and some sort of sane policy about fishing. And along those lines, well, we all need to rise again, perhaps as the United States needs to rise again now that it has even the potential of a balanced government for the first time in 12 years with the Democrats' victory. And as far as the Bush perspective goes from the environment, well, he didn't really have one, so we can only do better than that with the new administration. Along the theme of Rise Again, let's hear the Mary Ellen Carter from Canada's own Stan Rogers, the great folk hero of the East Coast.
She went down last October in a pouring driving rain. The skipper he'd been drinking and the mate he felt no pain. Too close to Three Mile Rock and she was dealt her mortal blow. And the Mary Ellen Carter settled low. There was just us five aboard her when she finally was awash. We'd worked like hell to save her, all heedless of the cost. And the groan she gave as she went down, it caused us to proclaim that the Mary Ellen Carter would rise again. Well, the owners wrote her off, not a nickel would they spend. She gave 20 years of service, boys that met her sorry end. But insurance paid the loss to us, so let her rest below. Then they laughed at us and said we had to go. But we talked of her all winter, some days around the clock. She's worth a quarter million afloat and at the dock. And with every jar that hit the bar, we swore we would remain and make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Rise again, rise again. Let her name not be lost to the knowledge of men. All those who loved her best and were with her till the end will make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. All spring now we've been with her on a barge lent by a friend. 3 dives a day in a hard hat suit, and twice I've had the bends. Thank God it's only 60 feet and the currents here are slow, or I'd never have the strength to go below. But we patched her rents, stopped her vents, dug hatch and porthole down, put cables to her fore and aft and girded her around. Tomorrow noon we hit the air and then take up the strain and make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Rise again, rise again. Let her name not be lost to the knowledge of men. All those who loved her best and were with her till the end will make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. We couldn't leave her there, you see, to crumble into scale. She'd saved our lives so many times, living through the gale. And the laughing drunken rats who left her to a sorry grave, they won't be laughing in another day. And you, to whom adversity has dealt the final blow, with smiling bastards lying to you everywhere you go, turn to and put out all your strength of arm and heart and brain, and like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again. Rise again, rise again. Though your heart it be broken and life about to end, no matter what you've lost, be it a home, a love, a friend, like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again. Rise again, rise. Though your heart it be broken or life about to end, no matter what you've lost, be it a home. the Mary of it part to rise again.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Don't forget, if you miss a show, you can always find these archived at our website at www.ecoshock.org. We have a podcast to offer you there as well, and a whole bunch of files you can download or listen to, not to mention the Net's only 24-hour all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org. The whole thing's free. There's nothing to sign up for. There's nothing to download. Just help yourself to some good environmental audio. To write to us or to suggest story ideas or even contribute your own green audio, whether it's music or a production that you'd like to make covering something about the environment, you can always contact us at radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock. That's E-C-O, shock, like an electric shock, .org. Well, speaking of that, we're going to get on with the Vancouver Sun headline story about chemicals impairing kids' brains in pandemic proportions with this report on the polluted womb with Dr. Frederica Pereira of Columbia University. It's all produced by Radio EcoShock. Following that, we'll have our sermon, Oh My Soul.
A report from Radio EcoShock.
I think you're all aware that asthma rates in children have increased dramatically in recent years. There's been a reported doubling in incidence rates in the last 20 years. And a recent study confirmed that 25% of elementary school children in Harlem had asthma. And developmental problems have also been increasing, even accounting for improved diagnosis. Rates of learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism have increased, and an estimated 15% of elementary or school children in the U.S. have at least one learning disability.
That's right. Classrooms full of wheezing kids with inhalers in their pockets. Postmodern kids have damaged DNA and diminished IQ because chemicals are hitting them right in the womb in their earliest stages of development. Okay, this is last year's news, but the horror of industrial damage to our new generation of humans hasn't really reached us. We definitely don't want to hear that our air, seeming so clear, is poisonous. And our vehicles, those magic things that let us fly across the ground, reach right into the womb and our lungs ever after. A team of researchers led by Dr. Frederica Pereira has proven this with a groundbreaking study in New York City. The team from Columbia University followed hundreds of mothers from the first discovery of pregnancy through infancy and early childhood. One of the most important discoveries? Pesticides and other industrial chemicals are mixing with car exhaust, a kind of unseen toxic smog that penetrates the womb and harms humans at every stage of life. Pesticides cause birth defects, damage DNA, and predispose children to diseases later in life, especially cancer. We know this by science and by the sick and dying people exposed to pesticides. Of course, you don't use pesticides, just Mother Nature brand soap in your home, so you're okay, right? Not really. As Dr. Pereira describes in a 40-minute speech given to congressional staffers, pesticides are everywhere. Municipalities spray them along roads to kill weeds and trees. Condo and apartment maintenance people use them liberally. Golf course spray adds to the aerosol mist of chlorinated poisons that float across the city. And your factory farm food is laced with fungicides, insecticides, and herbicides. Blood tests of random citizens, whether in Europe or North America, reveal 60 or more toxic chemicals running around in all of us. Trust me, you're getting your fair share of the chemical feast.
I've got mercury, lead, arsenic. I've got flame retardants. I've got the stain repellent. I've got PCBs. I've got pesticides. I've got insecticides. So, you know, digesting that and then thinking, well, these are carcinogens, these are toxins that are in me, and then thinking that we only tested for 88. So I have to just extrapolate that and think there are hundreds more in me, and there are hundreds more in everybody. you burst the bubble of denial pretty quickly.
The biggest non-surprise? Automobile smog combined with pesticides and stress form a super threat to human health. The exhaust of cars and trucks, which we all take for granted, is so powerful it crosses nature's protective barrier in the womb, the placenta, and injures our babies. The number of cars and trucks has more than doubled since the 1950s. We are producing a new damaged generation, the exhausted ones. Let's introduce Dr. Frederica Pereira from the Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia University. A stylish-looking woman, Dr. Pereira, known as Ricky to her friends, has that rare combination of vision and science and the skills to attract public agencies and dollars for the study of disadvantaged people. She argues it is far cheaper, not to mention more humane, to prevent diseases from the moment of conception than to pay for many lives of illness and disability. A small story about her study broke in the New York Times for February 16, 2005. It was an Associated Press piece titled, "Pollution is Linked to Fetal Harm." Google that title, the article pops up top of the pile. It reads, "Exposure to pollutants caused chiefly by vehicles was measured by backpack air monitors worn by the women during the third trimester of pregnancy. When the babies were born, genetic alterations were measured. Researchers found an increase of about 50% in the level of persistent genetic abnormalities among infants with high levels of exposure," said the study's senior author, Dr. Frederica P. Pereira, director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. Quote, "We already knew that air pollutants significantly reduced fetal growth, but this is the first time we've seen evidence that they can change chromosomes in utero," Dr. Pereira said, adding that the kind of genetic changes that occurred had been linked in other studies to increased risk of cancer. Well, those three paragraphs in the New York Times note that vehicle exhaust is altering the genes of newborns and a whole generation, and not in a good way. It's a shame that car pollution stories don't warrant the full-page spreads available to car makers and oil company advertisers. But Dr. Pereira said much more in a talk titled "Prenatal Exposures to Pollutants and Future Health Risks." It was part of a policymaker education course for congressional staff, organized by the Harvard Medical School Center for Health and the Global Environment. It was on March 30, 2005. You can be briefed like the Congress staff by watching the video. I'll tell you how to find the video and a better quality audio version of the speech later in this broadcast. 25% of inner-city kids with asthma? Autism and other birth defects spiraling. 15% of school kids with a learning disability. In the 1950s, when cars were just beginning, these things were rare. Now they're common and growing. Everyone and every teacher knows a family with a child with difficulties. You may think it's just a fad or over-medicalization until it happens to your family. Asthma, autism, and childhood cancer are not just a trick, but a heartbreaking struggle. These problems are worst for visible minorities who enjoy the dense traffic and truck or bus yards built into their already burdened neighborhoods. But who doesn't live near a highway now? Who doesn't inhabit an airshed loaded with vehicle exhaust? In a criminal oversimplification of the doctor's speech, she emphasizes three major causes of genetic deformation and disease in the womb and childhood. Pesticides, vehicle exhaust, and stress stand out from a complex weave of possible causes, once obvious things like tobacco, alcohol abuse, and heavy metals like lead are factored out. The study found that stress of living in pollution feeds the terrible stress of trying to raise sick or mentally challenged kids. It's a negative feedback loop. Cars and trucks produce many chemical combinations, but gasoline and oil are basically hydrocarbons. When they are burned, they emit particles called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. That chemical name is too long, so we use the acronym PAHs. PAHs can occur in nature when organic matter burns, perhaps in a forest fire, but that's nothing like the persistent flood of airborne PAHs produced by our transportation system. There are many types of PAHs, and some of them are highly carcinogenic, cancer-causing, and mutagenic, creating mutations of DNA even in the womb. PAHs are found in all sorts of petrochemicals like solvents and dyes, as well as burnt gasoline.
Roofing tar, creosote, and coal-fired power plants are strong sources of PAHs. So are cigarettes. But today, we're just focusing on vehicle exhaust.
For the PAHs, they are known carcinogens, developmental toxicants, and I'm referring to in experimental animals and or humans. And now there's beginning to be evidence that they also contribute to the causation of asthma. That is, prenatal exposures can contribute.
Breaking more new ground, this New York study tested the combination of chemicals in the real world as opposed to the standard government tests of individual chemicals by themselves.
We were quite ambitious in this research, and we're attempting to document exposures to all of these and to look at the effects of each one singly and then also in combination, because the real world, of course, is that you get exposed to all of these things. And previous studies have looked at one particular exposure at a time.
This is vital. Governments and chemical makers carefully isolate one chemical and test it on rats. They base the safety level, the amount you may be receiving, on this illusory system. In reality, all sorts of chemicals appear in untested combinations. We inhale and ingest a chemical smorgasbord that has never been tested on humans by anybody. We're all part of this global experiment to see what happens to human biology. Welcome to the experiment. Babies and kids are far more sensitive to environmental toxins than adults. The doctor explains why.
Now back to the this key issue that I can't hammer home enough. It is this heightened susceptibility in the developing fetus and young child. For many pollutants, at these life stages, the individual has differentially higher exposure. For the fetus, there's greater absorption and retention of certain toxicants, and that's true for the child as well. For the young child who is eating a great deal more food, ingesting a lot more food and water on a body weight basis than an adult, any pollutants in the food and water will also be ingested by that developing child. And then, of course, mouthing objects, crawling, that's another vector for exposure in the young child. So there's greater exposure, absorption, retention, but also the systems that we have operating we adults have operating at varying efficiencies, but much better than in the fetus and child. To detoxify chemicals and repair the damage they do to DNA are immature and not efficient in this early developmental period. And then the higher rate of cell proliferation puts cells, DNA, genes at risk and offers the potential for disruption in normal differentiation and growth. And then, of course, for carcinogens, there's just a lot more time for cancer to develop if the cancer is initiated as early as in utero. So there is concern about this window of exposure and susceptibility, and imagine what the preventive benefits could be if we could really take steps to protect this very sensitive period.
So in the Bronx and in Harlem, the team set up indoor air quality monitors and occasionally fitted the pregnant mothers with backpacks that measured pollution. That was all combined with blood tests, questionnaires, and a host of other measurement techniques. They followed up with health checks on the babies and followed the kids up to school age so far, all the while comparing the amount of pollution with the actual health of the children, both mental and physical. Science is proving that exposure to pollution sets up prenatal changes that can determine major diseases in childhood or even much later in life. The study doesn't just measure what toxins remain in the body. It shows the genetic damage caused by pollution.
This is a marker of genetic damage from, say, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, where the chemical has actually hit the DNA and latched onto it, and you can measure those fingerprints.
Chromosomes are damaged, immune systems compromised from birth by pollution. It's visible at a microscopic level, not a theory, but a provable fact. They studied the lives of 700 mothers. They found PAHs and pesticides in every air sample, in every breath they took.
And what we have found so far, I mean, I'm just going to give you a few highlights. The fetus is exposed to multiple toxicants. Air monitoring and questionnaire indicate that every single air sample taken during pregnancy, therefore every mother and every fetus, had prenatal exposure to PAHs and pesticides in air. And the levels did vary, and they appear to vary as a function of proximity of residents to major roadways, heavily trafficked roadways.
The fingerprints of DNA damage from PAHs was found in 40% of newborn babies. Organophosphate pesticides like diazinon were found in 100% of the babies. Doesn't the placenta, the blood barrier in the mother's womb, protect the unborn child?
Does the placenta provide any kind of barrier to large chemicals?
Yes, it does. The placenta is intended to do that, and it does do that. It reduces, it's been estimated from experimental studies that it reduces the level of PAHs, for example, by a factor of 10. And yet, I'll show you some findings that we have that suggest that even despite that protection, the fetus being more sensitive, less able to detoxify, repair damage, actually has as much or more DNA damage than the mother.
These pollutants also reduce birth weight, meaning more chance of illness or even reduced IQ in later life. Again, PAHs from auto exhaust and other carbon burners is now proven to reduce the survival of human offspring.
Prenatal exposures reduce fetal growth. Well, fetal growth is actually a very good predictor. Birth weight particularly has been particularly studied. Good predictor of later health and cognitive development of the child. So lower birth weight, even in the normal range, is associated with not only more health problems in childhood and adulthood, but less good functioning at school and less good scoring on cognitive tests and so forth, and even decreased IQ. So there is a concern about reducing fetal growth, and both PAHs and environmental tobacco smoke are associated with reductions in birth size.
As we said at the beginning, PAHs from vehicle exhaust and coal-fired power plants are directly driving the explosion of children with asthma.
Now, I haven't talked too much about asthma, but I did mention at the beginning the multiple effects of the same exposure. And Rachel Miller, who's a pulmonary physician and immunologist in our center, heading up the asthma work, has recently published with colleagues the finding that the babies had more respiratory problems at ages 1 and 2 years if they had had prenatal PAH exposure.
New York City spends $450 million a year for their early intervention programs, trying to help the victims of pollution. The cost of treating asthma in American children in 2002 was $7 billion. Of course, many of the growing number of children with asthma in China or Poland don't get treatment at all. Add more billions of dollars for the productivity loss resulting from a drop in IQ, a generation less smart, less able to solve the problems that polluted their young bloodstreams. These are powerful economic arguments to reduce urban pollution. What can be done? Some universities and institutes are trying, with presentations like this one, to reach the minds of policymakers to enact laws which reduce pollution. In 2002, the EPA began a phase-out of the worst organophosphate pesticides for residential use. A single insecticide called chlorpyrifos, sold as Dursban or Lorsban, was shown to affect not just mental ability in school children, but also body coordination. It was used in fumigation of cheap housing and, before the regulation, was part of consumer products like Raid. It's amazing that tobacco-like lawsuits haven't been launched by the millions of parents whose children will never go to college and who suffered or died due to this pesticide. After the EPA tightened regulations, just a little, Dr. Pereira's team saw an almost immediate decrease of these toxins in more recent blood tests. But chlorpyrifos is still being used on crops and shows up in kids' food and your food. Perhaps this study will help break down the generation-long wall of denial. Those who don't seem to care about city kids or kids at all may at least balk at the looming public health care crisis as a new generation of pollution-damaged humans develop. You can help by educating yourself and others. The web address for the Pereira video is just too long to repeat here. You can find the link in the EcoShock news blog at www.ecoshock.org/podcast.html. A better quality audio-only version of the speech is available from the downloads page at ecoshock.org. It's about 40 minutes long. The main thing is to wrap your mind around the reality of clouds of tiny chemical particles that you cannot see. air quality in most cities in the world is no longer suitable for pregnant women, babies, or children. At the very least, these groups need special protection. In the worst cases, such as downtown New York, or Beijing, Mexico City, or Los Angeles, or Toronto, pregnant women may want to do the unthinkable, wear a breathing mask over the face when out and about to protect the developing fetus from the smog of pesticides, chemicals, and exhaust. If the car, coal, and pesticide culture continues, pregnant women may even need to be evacuated into the countryside. Unthinkable thoughts. Once born, babies should be kept as high as possible from the roadway. Even a baby backpack is better than a low-slung stroller. In the 1990s, Greenpeace Germany measured vehicle exhaust at different heights. Accounting for the differences in lung and body size, they found a stroller would have to be at least 14 feet in the air to give the baby the same dose of air available to adults 5 feet off the ground. Anyway, down where the dogs are, it's bad air, and babies don't belong there. Incidentally, kids aren't safe inside the car either. It's even more polluted in there, close to that motor, than outside on the pavement. Again, a mask would offer some protection, and don't drive around with newborn babies more than necessary. Another obvious short-term solution is to install a HEPA air filter in the bedroom of pregnant women and young children to remove the particulates from car and diesel exhaust. Even with the windows closed, the general city smog is moving through the building. These are awful tricks for an awful time. To make air fit for humans, we need to remove the most toxic pesticides and chemicals and find a non-polluting form of transportation. And while we work toward that cleaner day, each of us needs to act now to reduce our personal consumption of polluting products. Reduce your personal exhaust. Some little lives are depending on it.
Natalie, I'm 9 years old and I have asthma. You know, when you have asthma, sometimes it's really hard to breathe. It makes you cough and wheeze and really feel sick. If you don't take your medicine, your lungs could be swelling up and you wouldn't even know it. Until all of a sudden, you feel like someone's choking you or an elephant sitting on your chest.
This report is from Radio EcoShock, non-stop all-environmental radio at www.ecoshock.org. We've been sampling music by Dave Kiefer from PodSafeAudio.com. Thanks, Dave. You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Oh, My Soul was written and presented by performance artist Kirsten Wilson. The following segment was recorded at a recent Bioneers conference.
Brothers and sisters, we are gathered here to discuss what must, if we shall succeed, be a spiritual revolution, an evolution from Homo sapiens sapien, revealingly redundant, to Homo economicus, well put, Max Oeschlager, to Homo naturalis. I will proceed directly to the heart of my sermon, which, for the sake of revolutionary gender reclamation, I drop the sir and add a ma'am, making this not a sermon, but a mammon. Yes! Yes, Buchanan, I said mammon. Which speaks to the natural and pantheistic instead of the mechanical and sadistic. We are talking about exchanging biopornography for biophilia. Pornography. That is the structure of domination which has replaced English as our national language. Everything translated into what I can possibly control or consume without being touched, changed, challenged, or connected. A language which transforms women into meat, animals into meat products, poor men into into machines and rich men into gods. But in their attempts to become gods, they have lost their souls. We all have. That is why I am up here preaching, my mammon. God did not throw us out of Eden. Brothers and sisters, we are throwing ourselves out every industrious day. The apple Eve ate was good. Sweet. But what about the apples now with their red, shiny, pesticidal coverings? Satan in the shape of Monsanto. But it's okay. I can afford organic. I am single, white, educated. I don't have children to feed. There will be poor with us always. Let them eat the pesticide-riddled fruit. Ha! Joke, riddle, on us. Genocide continues. Organic for the rich, toxic. Tap water for the poor. We have a lot of work to do if this re-evolution is really going to happen and save us. So, let us talk about salvation. And I do not mean a peach smoothie and a massage. I am talking about saving this planet and the people with it. How will we be saved? The environmental catastrophe appears overwhelming. We are afraid we cannot think our way out of this mess. Of course not. We must feel our way out. We must learn to listen with our hearts and our hands. If you are not in your body, you are not making sense. Literally. It is disembodied discourses that have got us into this crisis. We have worshipped the false gods of logic, progress, productivity, practicality. If destroying the earth for short-sighted economic profit is intelligent, reasonable, then please, God, make me a moron! This is a spiritual revolution about finding our ways back to the land, finding ways to be fed, spiritually fed. And it is not easy. I know. I myself have strategized on ways to make my plans fit their pathology. I have walked through the shadow of political expedience. I thought I'd do this whole campaign about changing the environmental reference to this earth from Mother Earth to Father Planet. Yeah. You see, I read all those, you know, those bumper stickers that were out, you know, those with the green earth globes that said, love your mother. And I despaired. I knew there was no hope. And I'm not even referring to the irony of having pro-planet language on the back of a car. Hallelujah. I am referring to the slogan, love your mother. It won't work. What America hates its mothers. I thought of Mother's Day and the men who give the mother of their children sentimental harlequin cards, then beat, rape, and silence them the other 364 days. No, I thought. No wonder we have an environmental crisis if we treat the earth the way we treat our mothers. Woo, we think mothers are made to be exploited. They are supposed to give and give and ask nothing in return. They are supposed to have infinite resources. All good mothers are willing to be drained, damned, and depleted for their children. Mothers live for their baby's feeding schedule, and there is always a little milk left for Exxon, Texaco, International Paper, and the U.S. military. I mean, I thought, but if nature was perceived as male, then maybe everything would be different. Think about it. I mean, it might not be nice to fool Mother Nature, but if you mess with Father Planet, he'll beat the shit out of you. Hail, hurricane and all. Yeah, and then maybe environmentalists would get the respect they deserve. No longer mama's boys and girls. Maybe they would be treated like real men and the real women who love real men. A name change to Father Planet is not enough. Fathers and mothers, we both need to be saved if this planet is going to survive. The environmental crisis points to a total ideological and spiritual crisis. Including the Earth in the economic equation is not enough. We are destroying the Earth for reasons that are bigger than economics. You see, we are afraid of death. We are afraid of this Earth, this nature that will bring us back to dust. We are afraid of the dust and the dirt that will claim us, or the waters that we came from, and thus afraid of women's bodies, the bridges by which we walk this earth. An intellectual atheist performance artist in spiritual crisis wrote this sermon. Because this revolution is about a religion in one of its original meanings, re-linking, reconnecting the lives of women raped and murdered daily are fought in a struggle. The lives of indigenous peoples are fought in this struggle. The men and women lost in the empty addiction of power, these infantile gods, will grow into their souls if we win. We must win. If the pioneers had a manifest destiny to colonize, control, and consume, then the pioneer should have a mammoth destiny to decolonize, create, and commune. But this must be a spiritual revolution, not just the environment separate and distinct from its home and all and everything. You see, if this is a spiritual revolution, if we get to feel as we fight, if we just get to feel as we fight, then we have already won. A men, a women, a planet, our souls.
So... Baby, 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 don't you know my love?
That's a segment from Oh My Soul, written and performed by Kirsten Wilson. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to The Pioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Visit our website, newdimensions.org.
That's it for this week's edition of Radio EcoShock. I hope you've been scared a little bit and enjoyed it a little bit too. Please join us every Friday at 1 o'clock from 1 to 2 on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver for All Environment Radio broadcast, Radio EcoShock. tell your friends, and we'll see you next week.